Good morning. Let me go ahead and call the Mesa City Council study session for Thursday, March 15th, 2007 to order. The first item will be to review items on the agenda for the March 19th regular council meeting. Yes, let me go ahead and excuse Councilmember Kyle. Kyle Jones, yeah. Councilmember Kyle. Councilmember Jones, Kyle Jones. Yeah, we've been spending some time together back in D.C., and I think he's with a group in Boston, actually, of high school students, so he's still working. let's go ahead and go through the agenda. Anything on page one for Monday night? Page two? Minutes, we have some public hearings. Page three, liquor license applications, contracts. Do I have any conflicts on the contracts? Anybody have any items that were noted? I haven't gone through this in detail, so don't know.
No, I don't think so.
All right.
Not on contracts.
All right. That's page three, page four. On page four, we get into introduction of ordinances, continued on page five. Yes, Councilmember Griswold.
Just on page five, a note on 8B and 8C. If we could put districts on there, you know, where they are. I know we're looking at maps on there, but it's sort of a reoccurring request. I probably pay a little more attention to my district to make sure I really go and visit the property, et cetera. So thank you.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. On page four, item 7B, I want to thank the staff for the work that they did on this. This is part of what came out of the Lehigh sub-area plan that we all looked at a while ago, and it had to do with making sure that people who have horse privileges and things like that can have fences that come around in their front yard so that they can keep their animals in, which obviously is logical, but we had some code issues that we needed to address, and staff did a wonderful job of expediting that. So I just want to thank everybody involved. Thank you.
Okay. 8A is off consent, so we can have the public hearing first. Okay. All right, that's resolutions on page 8. Page 9, with ordinances, zoning cases. Continued on page 7. 9E, I believe, is Tom and I have a conflict on that one. Is that?
Tom's out of town.
Oh, okay, so I'll declare the conflict and keep 9E off. All right, and that's it. Anybody have any items for Monday night's meeting?
Just one question. We've introduced Lowe's already on both cases, so there's no other introduction that's necessary for this week?
No.
Okay, just want to, I thought we had, but I just want to make sure.
Did we set May 23rd or something? Okay. What was the date on that? 21st? Okay. Okay. All right. Item number two is to hear a presentation and discuss the management review of the Mesa Police Department performed by the Police Executive Research Forum.
Mayor, Councilwoman, the chief is making his way up. If you recall, this is the item that I initiated almost a year ago to move forward with a review of the police department at the council's request. Support. And so here today, the chief is here to not only report on the study itself, the review, but I believe the chief and his staff have also sat down, gone through the report, and then provided some responses or follow-up actions from items that have been presented in the review. So thank you, chief.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, council members. I have here with me Assistant Chief Solanka, Director of Support Services, and I have Assistant Chief Les Portee, who is acting director of operations. And what I'd like to do is just give you a brief overview of the report, some of the things that we're recommending to do, also a couple of other things that will be coming down your way soon, and then we'll open it up for questions. First of all, as I'm sure you had at least a brief opportunity to peruse for this report, there are 139 recommendations, and what we did in order to facilitate your review is that we attach our responses and we actually number each of the recommendations with a page number and a paragraph because we recognize that everybody's really busy and we wanted to facilitate your review. The report is basically breaking down into several major areas. We have business processes, we have homeland security, there is administrative reports, there is discipline, off-duty employment pursuits, and many other areas that I would not enumerate for you. But some of the things that are highlighted here and I like to bring out to your attention is there are things that talk about critical areas for us, such as use of force, reporting of personnel complaints, some of the problems that we have with overtime reporting, jail holding facilities, our legal unit, consistency of handling personnel complaints, training, hiring, and our records management system. As you can see by our responses here, we basically broke down each of these categories, and we're providing you with a response to the category and also a timeline as to when we can perform some of these functions. Some of these functions will require funding, such as the holding facilities, for instance, and that is something that we are certainly in the discussion with you and concerning whether we want to include this in the bond fund or not. Others are already completed. For instance, in the area of use of force report, you're well aware that we already started to work in this area. We took our TASER policy. We have rewritten our TASER policy. In the area of overtime reporting, the FLSA issues that were noted, that was something that I realized that we were having a problem as soon as I got here. We immediately corrected that so that it's no longer a problem. Concerning the restructuring of internal affairs, we have already started that process. Director Salonka has already begun the reconfiguration of that unit. We now have a commander that oversees that unit. We have also, as part of that process, begun to upgrade some of our civilian employees to commanding officer role in the area of information technology, as well as the area of fiscal operations and our PIO's office. So many of these things are already on the way. Others, as I indicated, it's going to take some time. Concerning our records management system and our information technology, we're actually on, as we're speaking right now, we have a team from Oracle. Oracle Corporation actually has given us about a $60,000 pro bono work. They're talking to our people, they're reviewing our systems, and as a matter of fact, I'm scheduled to meet with a management team from Oracle this evening to get an early assessment of the review. And what are some of the things that we can do in order to fix the system. So basically, all in all, out of the 139 recommendations, many have already been corrected. Others are in the process of being corrected. And then there are some that will require funding from the city, and those obviously would be those that we would require dialogue with you, and you will have to make a decision as to whether you want to go forward with them, and if you do, to what extent. And I'd like to basically open it up for any questions that you may have now. We're three of us are here ready to answer any questions concerning this report.
Okay. Questions from council members? Council member Griswold.
I was just pleased reading through the report that most of the items on there, I know you'd talked to us previously about and you're already working on before even the report came out. So I think that was a good proactive step, and a lot of things you recognize coming in new, the report recognized, and it sort of gave us some good marching orders to make it into a modern top-ranked police force. So I think we're a good police force now. I think we can be one of the top ones in the country.
There's no question about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilmember Whalen.
Morning, Chief.
Good morning.
Chiefs. The change of from the a merit position for commander and assistant chief to at will from the chief. It's a personnel rule change and is in process, I understand?
Right. Actually, we already started that process. The two directors that Chief Salonka and Chief Otañez are already at will in that position as a director. And any new commanders that are promoted or any future assistant chief or directors would be at will to that rank. Basically, what that will mean in our terms is that If the individual, for whatever reason, does not become a fit to that level, they would revert back to their last merit position. In the case of people that currently have merit status as a commander, will revert back to commander, or new commanders will revert back to lieutenant.
And then in the area of decentralization of traffic motors, when will that take place, and what's your timeline?
Right, that one we're still reviewing. There is what we're trying to do with the decentralization is also make sure that it makes sense all the way around. Our stations were not designed to handle as many people as if we currently have. As a matter of fact, Dobson is really a major problem for us, because these were stations that were designed only to hold patrol personnel, and quite frankly, limited number of patrol personnel. We now have detectives in there. We have our street crime units. So adding traffic to those will certainly add to the load, but it's certainly something that is under consideration. And in an ideal world, eventually it may occur. We just have to weigh between facilities, placement of people, and overall performance of the organization.
And then, Chief, the one recommendation to replace, when vacant, the two assistant police chief assignments currently in operations and support with the operational sergeants, and then you would then create a chief of staff assistant chief's position, so there'll still be three assistant police chiefs.
Right. Yeah, we're still in the process of analyzing the recommendation. One of the things also that we have to ensure is that we start grooming the next generation of management for the police department. As I think everyone in this council is aware, most of our command staff is in the drop program, so within a period of about 3 years or so, 10 out of 13 people will no longer be able to hold their current positions. We really haven't had a good succession plan, so one of the things that we have to wait is the consideration of reducing our top staff also at the same time that we have to groom people, and quite frankly, sometimes in order to groom people, you got to put them in the swimming pool and see whether they can swim, and then you got to help them, and you got to do before that they have to swim alone. So we have to weigh the two. So my plan at this point, frankly, may be to continue to possibly run another assistant chief over and above. We have kept that vacancy for the chief of staff, and our goal is to put somebody in that place. But really what we're talking about is the grooming of the future generation of leaders for this organization, which is critical.
One of the concerns of decentralization of investigations is sharing of information. I noticed the report talked a little bit about that. I think your CompStat process probably will help a great deal in that sharing. Would it be possible for Public Safety Committee to convene in a CompStat meeting in the near future so we could observe that process?
I think it would be great if you did. You know, our CompStat meetings are open to the public, so certainly it would be great to have the Public Safety Committee there. I have to tell you, one of the problems that we are having with CompStat is facilities. We're having to move around the city, sometimes almost on a meeting-by-meeting basis. Sometimes we're being displaced at the last moment, which really create problems for us. So we're working under very difficult conditions when it comes to holding those meetings. But they are open to the public, and certainly the Public Safety Committee, or their entire council for that matter, is welcome to come.
A lot of changes. How's morale?
You know, I'd like to believe that it's a lot better than it used to be, but of course I'm biased. So I think I think there are still issues. I think overall it's much better than it is. I think if you look at the fact that our people are not leaving, that we're almost fully staffed on a regular basis. And I said it on a regular basis because obviously daily you have people that are being hired and people that are leaving, retiring. But we don't have people leaving the organization other than retirements, and even those have really slowed down significantly. We're pretty fully staffed right now. There's a tremendous amount of creativity going on. I think if you came to some of our CompStats, in fact, you would see that. People are energized. So I think overall it's good. Obviously, we have taken a lot of people out of their comfort zone. You know, we as human beings do not like, by nature, too many new things all at one time. And for some folks, it's really the world has been turned kind of upside down. But I would say that, that by and large, people are stepping up to the plate. You're seeing cases that are being put together today that would not have been put together if it weren't because detectives and patrol are working so closely together. We have new things coming down the line. Our crime, our street crime units are really beginning to perform extremely well. We're getting ready to launch an intelligence unit to deal with our hardcore crimes. One of the things that has been discussed in this council, for instance, the fact that we have at least 75 recorded halfway houses and many others that are not. We are probably receiving about 60% of all the people that leave the state correction system are coming to Mesa. Completely unacceptable. I know that Vice Mayor Walters is working, trying to come up with some legislative solutions, but quite frankly, I recognize that those are going to take time. So one of the things that we're going to start doing is targeting people before they come out of the prison system. We know that generally within 72 hours of getting out of the prison system, they commit their first crime. And our goal is going to be that if they do so, that they will be rehoused in the prison system very quickly. We have two ATF agents now that are embedded within our department. We have one officer that has been working with ICE since September, working on major smuggling operations. In fact, we have a pretty significant case that will probably break out in the next few months that is going to be huge. I'm on the process of bringing some people from the Marshal's office, from the regional fugitive task force. I just talked to them as people that I work with in LA, and I just became aware of that actually Arizona is part of their territory, so we're going to tap into those resources. Our crime intel unit that we're going to put together, a violent felon crime unit, will have an FBI analyst will be working with us about 80% of the time. We're looking at embedding some other federal agents here in our city working with us. So there's a lot of things going on. The goal is, you know, as I think you have already saw by the report here, we're talking about trying to reduce Part 1 crimes by 15% this year. That's going to be a tough goal. But crime in the city is still too high. You know, we're about 51 Part 1 crimes per 1,000 residents. By comparison, the city of L.A., which many people would deem more violent, has 34. And in general, the Valley is not doing well. I mean, if you look at the Part 1 crimes per 1,000, by most Valley cities are really high. And I think part of it is that, well, maybe I shouldn't talk about other departments. I'm just going to talk about ours. I think we haven't been as good as we could be, and we're certainly moving in that direction.
Thank you.
Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Chief. Several questions. First of all, what happens to our Part 1 crime rate? First of all, would you mind describing what a Part 1 crime is?
Not at all. Part 1 crimes is basically it's all your serious crimes. So you're talking about homicides, rape, aggravated assault, robbery, burglary, vehicle theft, arson. And that is a uniform reporting process. It was put together by the federal government in the late 20s. And really the goal there was to create a single definition of this crime so that throughout the country we could compare one jurisdiction against another and be able to at least gauge police performance as it relates to those definitions of crimes. Frankly, I mean, another problem that we have, we're probably under-reporting crime in the city of Mesa. So not only are we very high already at about 51 per 1,000, but because of systems issues, we have recognized that, for instance, in the area of aggravated assault, we probably underreported aggravated assault significantly in the year 2006 and probably 2005. So we're going to be cleaning up our numbers, which means that actually we may actually see what appears to be an increase in crime when in reality it is not. But we really need to clean up our numbers to be able to have a good gauge of what crime we have.
Without trivializing what this kind of crime, what happens if you take the auto thefts out? Because I know Arizona has been number one in the country in an area where we don't want to be number one, and that's auto thefts. Now it's gotten a little bit better, but does that impact at all how that number looks?
Actually, it really doesn't. I mean, we have some problem areas throughout, so you can't really single it out. I can tell you that, for instance, in the area of auto theft, we have had a 12% reduction year to date. And auto theft is probably one of those crimes where really there is no underreporting because the car is gone. I mean, there's probably a few crimes where generally you can you can assume that they're good numbers. Homicide is one of them because it's tied to a body that somebody finds somewhere, and the other one is auto theft. Other crimes, you know, there is sometimes game playing that goes even from city to city. But auto theft, we're doing very well. If you look at our year-to-date figures, we're down 12% year-to-date. Last year, we were at 356. This year-to-date, we're at 315. So we're doing well, and this is a good, hardcore number. The reality is that we have other crimes that need to come down that are, you know, like burglaries. We're doing really well. We're down 32% in burglaries. Last year, we were 129. This year, we're at 88. If you go right across the board, we're just high in some areas that we shouldn't be, and we're working really hard to bring those numbers down.
So when you look at, when you're looking at these numbers and you're seeing some areas that are high, then this part of this CompStat situation is that you then target that and you work on techniques to bring those numbers down.
That's correct. And one of the things that we do, a concept that I started in LAPD is the 10% concept, and it's based on a study by NIJ that says that 10% of the suspects commit roughly 50 to 55% of the crime. 10% of the victims account for about 40% of the victimization, and 10% of the places account for about 60% of where crimes occurred. What I did in LA is I developed three circles, put them in a triangle, and where those circles intersect, that is the area that we would focus. And primarily what we're talking about is the use of resources where it matters most. And that is what we're doing in Mesa. We started targeting suspects, places, and victims. We're a long way from being where I want it to be, but we're certainly getting better, and part of that is the CompStat process. One of the things that you will see rolling out by this summer, and in fact, I'm hoping that by mid-April, a contract will be coming to you to engage in the purchase of a new software system. It's called CopLink, and we have been fortunate enough to work what I think is a very economically well-structured contract. And you're going to see that is one of the systems that is really going to further help us in focusing on our 10%. And there are other things that are coming down the line that you will see that will really help us, our mapping systems. Today, for instance, in our mapping system, we still have difficulties targeting crime exactly where it's occurring, because the way our records management system works is when a radio call comes out, the location of the radio call becomes the location of the crime. Well, sometimes somebody may be reporting the crime from a different place than where the crime is actually occurring. Under the current system, it's a default process that becomes the location, and unless the officer, the detective, goes back and fixes that later on, which many times they may not, that the location of the crime could be an erroneous place. Also, it's a default system as to the type of crime based on the radio call. Now, sometimes we know that we may get a call of an unknown trouble, or we may get a call that says aggravated assault in progress, but when we get there, it really wasn't an aggravated assault, it was a robbery. Well, if the officer does not fix that, again, we end up with the initial coding. So we have a lot of things to do yet, but to answer your question, I know I got a little long-winded, but I wanted to explain it more broadly, is that we are focusing on where the problems are, and that's where we're applying our resources.
But I've got a couple of more questions here. First of all, the Phoenix ordinance, and Chris, I'm sort of looking at you on this one. A couple of months ago, I called again over to Phoenix to make sure that our laws were lining up with theirs in terms of halfway houses, and I discovered that they had recently passed an ordinance that had to do with what they called private prisons. And I had requested that we get that language, that we bring it to the Mesa City Council for potentially adopting that. It was limiting the use of private prisons to commercial and industrial zones. And I'm not sure what's happened to that or where it is. So I'd like to see that come back again. I don't know if that would address any of the issues that the chief is talking about. And Debbie, maybe I should be looking at you. Maybe it ended up in your office.
Vice Mayor, after our conversation a couple weeks ago, I went back and looked at that, and I think I meant to bring that for you today. I do have some language from the Phoenix Code that I believe is what you were looking for.
Well, maybe we can get it on a study session agenda. One of the other things that came to my attention as a result of a meeting I was in is that we do a good job around here of keeping track of where a lot of these facilities are. And I think Department of Corrections calls and says,
Do you have facilities in Mesa where people can go? And we, you know, we, yes, this is where the facilities are. And I'm wondering if we need to ask the other cities, because I think that perhaps they aren't identifying those locations for Department of Corrections. And either Department of Corrections needs to get in the game with us and say, we need a fair share here, or we need to stop sharing that information with Department of Corrections, because it simply is not acceptable. It is not acceptable for the city of Mesa to be bearing a burden for the entire state on this issue, and whatever we need to do to make sure that we are not bearing a greater share of the burden than we should be, I think we have to do. Now, we're working on some of the issues that we need to federally, but some of these things may be a case of practice. It isn't that the city of Mesa has invited folks to come here who are out on parole or whatever it happens to be. But it may be that practices that we're engaged in may make it easier for the Department of Corrections to identify facilities that are available here.
Yeah, there's no question about it that we're an easy target for people to displace or put down their undesirables. And frankly, that's why, in addition to other things that we're working with you and others, that we're just going to take a really hardcore enforcement approach to displaces. We know that, again, if you go back to that 10% concept, those people are committing a lot of crimes. You know, when we arrest a burglar, generally speaking, that burglar is committing another 20 to 30, 40 burglaries a month. And we have had some people in custody now that have admitted to that many cases. And that's not unique to Mesa. That's the way burglars work. So you got people that are really impacting our community very significantly, and we're definitely working on it. I must point out something else here, though, and I think I'd like to plant the seed that we also need to recognize that as we become more efficient with what we have, we also need to look at the future, at the ratio of police officers to residents, because we are certainly lower than a city of this size and the social structure should be. But I'm not asking for that today. I want to keep that in the forefront, that we're about 1.7, 1.8 officers per 1,000 residents. That's a good ratio for a suburb that has a very low crime rate and very few people. It is not the ratio for a city of this size with the socioeconomic problems that we have.
Well, you must be reading my mind, because the next question that I had here, actually the final one that I had, was measures of police per 1,000 or per resident. There seemed to be a different kind of, if you go to page 6 of your report, there seemed to be a different kind of, I'm probably on the wrong page. No, it's page 5, I'm sorry. If you go to page 5, there seems to be a different kind of system for reviewing it. It talked of review of calls for service, workload, and it said it fell within the range of for comparable city police departments.
Right.
But it then went on and recommended some areas where you needed to increase the number of officers. Is it your feeling that their measurement is incorrect because of what you just said?
Well, I think what they're talking about, what the available time per officer is during the day, and they're talking that it's somewhere between 36 and 45% of the time. The problem that we have with this numbers, and I'm not faulting PERF, I think PERF, by the way, did a wonderful job. The problem is that we have a CAS system that, for instance, when it comes to officers, accounting for officers' time involving in a particular call, it only accounts for the primary officer, so the secondary officers are not being counted. So, for instance, an officer could be tied up at a crime scene for 2 or 3 hours as a secondary officer. The system will show him or her as being cleared. So we have some real reporting problems. I think another number that also could be looked at is the ratio of police officers per 1,000 residents, and we're right around somewhere between 1.7, 1.8, depending on what you believe the population of the city to be. And if you look at, well, because, I mean, I know that we're looking at around 450,000, but there are other people that would argue that our population is larger than that, certainly larger than that for 3 or 4 months of the year. And if you look at the other major cities around the country, even LA, which is terribly under police, has about 2.4 police officers per 1,000 residents. I'm not advocating a New York model. I think the East Coast is sometimes not as efficient as they could be, but certainly somewhere between what we have and what LA has and what some of those other major cities have ought to be a good spot for us. You know, when you have a city as large as we have geographically and the number of officers that we have, our officers become firefighters, meaning they're running from call to call, and that's okay when you're fighting fires. It is not okay in the policing business where you need to have a lot of human interaction on a regular basis, because the solutions to crime mostly are going to come from the people themselves working with the police. And when you're running from radio call to radio call, you really don't have the ability to have that interaction. Now, I understand that policing is very expensive also, so the question becomes one of balance. But somewhere between what we are and what the ideal is, there's got to be a balance somewhere there.
Well, I appreciate that, Chief, and I appreciate the work that you're doing on, I know you're converting some of the sworn positions into civilian positions and doing some other things to try and engage more officers on the street. And I know that this council will work with you to try and yeah, figure out ways. Thank
you. We appreciate it. Believe me, I'm used to working with more difficult councils.
Rex.
Just to give you some anecdotal on morale, Councilman Wayland asked, I was talking to a young officer who was an ex-baseball player about a year ago and asked him if he knew any, if he'd play baseball if they didn't keep score. And he said, no, it'd be, you know, sort of a silly game if you didn't have any score. And I said, do you know any of your statistics on burglaries? And he goes, no. This year, he's starting to know, we're down 12%, we're down, yep, you know, et cetera. So they're starting to keep score, and the game gets more interesting when you work hard and you see an improvement.
Absolutely.
The morale goes up than if you just shovel sand against the sea all day and never see any improvement. So.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, when I first came here, I asked people, what is the rate of Part 1 crimes per thousand, and I would get this blank stares. Today, we're starting to see people that can rattle them back.
Okay. Scott.
Chief, what's the status of the school resource officer program? An alternative program that we were looking at?
Yeah, I don't want to let completely the cat out of the bag because we're not, but let me say a couple of things. I have been in dialogue with school superintendent Deb Duval for months now. We both want to resolve this. We believe there are some creative ways of dealing with this problem that would reduce the cost significantly and possibly allow the school district to pay for part of the service. And we're exploring those. Our goal is to hopefully by the time September rolls out, we will have some form of a replacement process. It may include a variety of things, including possibly hiring retired officers to come and work. It may also include maybe in some cases open it up for overtime, but having a small number of people that would have to commit to work in a particular day of the week, because part of school resource officers, you want people to be known, you want people to develop relationships. So if you put a different person there every week, then you cut tremendously in the effectiveness of the program. On the other hand, we don't need to have people that are getting paid to work the entire year because the schools are not open the entire year, or perhaps working 10-hour days, which is what our officers regularly get paid to do. So I think we can find a solution that could be funded elsewhere and give us what we're looking for. But it's still in the early developmental stages, and I hope to be able to be prepared to come to you in the summertime maybe with a solution that would be fiscally responsible and would take care of the problem for us.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Chief, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Item number three is hear a presentation and discuss the Series 2007 general obligation bonds, utility system revenue bonds, and street and highway user revenue bonds.
Good morning, Mayor, Council members. Anthony Araza, CIP Administrator for the city. To my left is Larry Given, our bond consultant from Peacock, Hislop, Staley, and Given. They've been doing our bond sales for a number of years. Also in the audience is our bond counsel as well, Keith Hoskins, and various staff members to answer any questions you may have. I'll go ahead and kick it off with this summary that you see. This first slide is also in your council report, but this is also to show folks at home watching our telecast. Grand total for the Series 2000 bond sale is $93,400,000. We also have approximately $288 million left in current authorization. Now, most of that is of course, from the utility bond category, and that's due recently to the November 2006 utility bond election that voters approved for all utility categories. I'll start off with the utility revenue bond category. This represents all utilities in Mesa that we currently service our customers, and that's the electric, gas, water, and wastewater programs. As you can see in this Series 2007 sale, this is lower comparatively to other bond sales we've had in the past, and that's mainly due to large utility facilities that were finishing up and have been in previous bond sales. So there are not too many of the large facility utility projects in this bond sale. Next one is the HERF bonds, or highway user revenue bonds. And this is highway the way this HERF debt is paid is from highway user revenues that we receive from the state. Now, this will more than likely be our last HERF bond sale as we move away from issuing new debt for HERF debt for street capital projects in our program. So projects in this sale have been previously approved and are contractually obligated. The last one, bond categories, are general obligation bonds. This $15.9 million sale only includes public safety and storm sewer projects. Now, the remaining GO bond authorization noted is only for these two categories as well. Now, the GO bonds has been of interest lately to council, so I'd like to focus on the public safety category and two projects in this sale that may be of interest to you that you will be seeing within the next 12 months. First one is the Tech Services Building, or the Crime Lab. Currently, we are using what we call a construction manager at risk for this project. It's an alternative project delivery method that we're employing for this project. And we anticipate bringing the guaranteed maximum price, or GMP, from the contractor to approve the construction of this building. We anticipate bringing this to you in June of this year. So this falls within the 12-month time frame that these bonds will now cover. Should be noted, though, however, approximately $9 million is anticipated for this 12 months, and then the subsequent amount of $5.26 million of bonds would be required and need to be sold for the next Series 2008 bond sale in order to complete the project.
Where's the location of this construction going to take place?
Currently, it's located between police admin building and the structure.
Okay.
Located kind of behind in that area.
And has that whole area been, I assume it's all been master planned with the new court and how that'll all fit in? Do we have a...
Well, we only have the technical, we call it the public safety campus, and Tech Services Building is currently being planned there, but...
And then, Mayor, to the point, I think, is then there are plans ultimately, and I think the Chief talked about it last week, that we need to go back to Public Safety Committee about then what do we do with the old court building once that's vacated also. So I think there is a plan for the development of public safety campus, is what we're referring to it,
yes,
with all the buildings that are in that area.
Okay, I just want to make sure that before we put this in, we think about what the whole court building is going to be used for and how it's good.
Yes.
It doesn't, it's like, darn, we shouldn't have built it there.
Right.
Type of
right.
Stuff.
No, I think, and that's part of the, on that list of items that the police department brought back last week includes the discussion about the future use of that, the court building.
Right, and I think the whole issue about additional incarceration, if we're ever going to get into it, and holding facilities, has to be brought back up for discussion.
Sure, and that's on that list too.
All right, okay. All right, go ahead.
The second project in the GO bond category in public safety is a new city court building. Now, we are also using CM at risk methodology for the design and construction of this facility. And we are anticipating bringing GMP, or guaranteed maximum price, from the contractor for your approval in December 2007, January 2008 timeframe. So that falls at the tail end of this bond sale 12-month period. Now, of that 15.9 million, within the next 12 months would be 2.6 million to finish design and start construction activity within this 12 months. Should be noted, however, an additional amount of 29.4 million of GEO bonds would need to be required and sold in the series 2008 sale and the 2009 bond sales in order to complete this project.
Okay, have we done any updates on construction costs? Is this still, are we far enough along with construction manager at risk to even get a concept of whether this will be adequate money?
Mayor, we've spoken to the CM at risk contractor and our designer, and we have given them the cap amount of which they have to design and construct that city court in that amount. So negotiations are going on with the design architect, and we are proceeding with designing that. We're at 30% right now. Now we're proceeding with the finished design for this building.
I guess what's the backup plan? If it comes in more, then where do you get the funding from, or how does that work?
Mayor, we have not received the first cost estimate from the contractor, or from our CM at risk contractor, but we're confident at this point that we can bring the building in under budget. It's just a matter of working with the contractor and setting our priorities. But within the next few weeks, we should have our first round of cost estimates, and then we'll work from there.
Right, Jack?
Mayor, we'll oversee that. Typically, our initial costs are relatively high compared to the estimates, and we typically do value engineering with that, and we'll work with the courts to do that.
Okay. And what is the time frame on the contract with the Brown and Brown parking garage? I'm just thinking about that whole other block as it pertains to access and parking in downtown. Has anybody evaluated that lately? It seems like everybody is moving to the freeways and other car dealerships. Hopefully they'll stay in the downtown area. I'd just like to know what the terms and conditions of that agreement are.
Oh, as far for us?
For us.
We can check on that, Mayor, but I don't know of any timelines at this point.
Okay.
But to your point real quickly, Mayor, when we were going through the discussion on the court building, one of the things that we owe back to, and I guess we would go back to which committee, probably maybe Audit and Finance, was when we got to a point where we were ready on the design component of the court was at a certain phase, we were going to bring that back to that council subcommittee to kind of just go over it again, because you know we obviously want to maintain within budget, but even within budget we want to make sure we're still designing a building that is appropriate and reasonable for the funds we have. So we are, I think, getting to a point close where we need to bring that back onto a committee for that review and update also.
Okay, and the building on Main Street, the DHS building or whatever the...
Oh, right, that, correct.
Any updates on it as far as a potential sale or...
Yes. Trying to remember. I need to get that. Next week or so, I think we have a variety of different items on real estate. Maybe we could get Doug to update us on that. I know we have a broker that's actively marketing that property, but I can't remember if we've got any active offers at this
point. We have a broker, and I don't think we have any solid offers yet.
Was there any tie-in to those funds needing that sale to help to complete the dollar magnitude to construct the court building? Those aren't linked, are they?
No.
No.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Well, that concludes the presentation, Mayor.
Yes.
So the sale is length?
Mayor, in our discussion with council last year on the, and I'm going to draw back on my memory here, we had identified some savings we were going to get in the quality of life program from pool maintenance, but we were also utilizing a little bit, I think it was $1 million from the sale of the land at the DES building, ultimately to offset that court cost was part of our way to fund the additional facilities for the court.
We'll bring all that back to the council committee. Okay. So we can refresh our memories and update on the cost and the funding sources.
And I just want to make sure that the amount sold is sufficient to get it built and that you've got enough bond proceeds. If not, there's another other way to shift things around here or come back for another sale later before the building is totally completed because of the construction frame or whatever it is.
Yes, Mayor, these projects both are co-funded with, as Brian mentioned, quality of life funds, and other revenue sources. This is just the geobond portion of these projects.
So you could pull some quality of life out and then substitute something back, or if you needed to. Okay.
Correct.
All right. Mike.
I think the Brown & Brown Garage tenure is up at the end of 2008, where it becomes free to them to do whatever they wish to with it.
Okay.
My understanding.
Kind of my recollection, too. Okay.
So we're seeking approval, I guess, from staff to move forward with solicit bids for the all of the three types of sales.
Mayor, actually, this will be on the council agenda, formal approval for Monday night for us to move to market. We'll be doing that in mid-April.
Okay, so there's no confusion. These have already been approved by the voters.
Yes.
Said, yes, you can spend this money. And we kind of have a list of projects that would probably fit within that category. We're now going through and say, this is what we need to complete some of these.
And the debt service is within our financial projections.
Okay. This is not a new issuance of anything. It's already been approved.
That's correct.
All right.
Again, please just say it one more time, Mayor.
Right.
Is that the debt service related to the sale of these bonds has already been included in our forecast that we've anticipated all along, so this is not going to create any more pressure within the budget than we've already planned for. Now, one of the things we have done, though, is you'll notice we are really trying to tighten up, even authorize sell or authorize bonds. We're really trying to tighten up how much we're even selling. So we're trying to be very careful. We're not just selling all that's available. We're trying to be very judicious in that also.
Right. And in our forecast and what the existing bond market as far as rates, how does that look?
Mayor, I'm Larry Given with Peacock, Hislop, Staley & Given. Actually, the bond market's in pretty good shape. If you recall back in early December when we sold the big refunding issue, right, where rates were low, the rates are right back on that this week. So hopefully they'll be maintaining this or to a lower level come 3 weeks from now when we take, or 4 weeks from now when we take bids. So we're in good shape so far. In fact, staff has asked us to look at refunding issues. There are a couple potentials that I would never have expected to be down here again this low with the rates, but we're taking a look at them. If they're available and they make sense, we'll bring, again, one of those parameters resolutions to the council, one or two of those in the coming weeks. We'll just monitor that.
Yeah, I think the last refunding put in about $4 million. So.
Well, don't expect that again, Mayor. I think that's what the staff was looking for.
I was just shooting for a target for you.
Rates aren't that low.
All right, any other questions on this?
I just want to make sure I understand this. We're going to go with 15.9, of which 5 million is storm sewer?
That's correct.
But those numbers don't compute with the public safety numbers. Are those storm sewers involved in the public safety facilities?
No. Councilmember Whalen, those storm sewer projects are mostly contractual obligations that we have with the County Flood Control District.
Right. But my question is 9 million of the $10 million public safety goes into the crime lab, and $2.6 million of the $10 million goes into the court. Those numbers don't compute.
Oh, in your council report, there are a couple of other projects that are in there. Yeah. One is a chill water line that's going through, which is contractually obligated, and then the wireless fire suppression system.
Okay. Why are storm sewers not utilities?
Once you set up a stormwater utility, you could, but they are not covered under the revenues of the water, wastewater. But there are models that I'm familiar with where you can set up a stormwater utility. And, you know, we implemented what do we call the fee?
The federal environmental compliance fee.
You know, which is funding some of that stormwater. But that's, you know, something to look at down the road. But it doesn't fit within the current utility design we have today.
It's just something like that would make more sense than
putting
under
Mayor, the Councilmember Whalen, just to explore, we had something that we explored for Tucson and for this city a few number of years ago. I'm going to date myself now. It's back in the early 90s when budgets were tight. And the problem is the source of revenue. You really need a source of revenue when you're doing a utility. We don't have one for the storm sewers. It's basically to pay bonds out of the general fund. And at the time, there were some unique ways that people came up with to generate revenues, which I won't go into right now, but it was determined at that time that neither Tucson nor Mesa were going to engage in that. But there are ways that have to connect to sort of development fee kind of aspects to them that other cities have utilized, and it's something we've looked at.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn.
Any other questions? Rex?
just go to that same matter, you know, the whole point is new growth needs to pay for itself. A lot of these storm drains are in the newer areas of town, and the rest of the city is subsidizing the building and those, and there's no mechanism to recapture.
Right.
So every time we build, the rest of us have to subsidize all the new growth. And there is no legal mechanism in our current budget or current charter that allows us to recapture any of this.
Well, since you're, Councilmember Griswold, since you asked that question, I can tell you that to try to develop a fee that annually would be levied as part of a utility fee, such as a user fee for water and sewer services, we come up with such things. There's no good way to measure stormwater, like you can out of your drain for, you know, there's no good way to measure. So it comes out to a square footage type arrangement or what kind of your geology or your geography is in that area. It becomes very complex, and that's part of the reason why the things kind of broke down about 15 years ago when we were looking at that. It's hard to make a really inaccurate fee for everybody because there's going to be a lot of disparity. So,
Councilmember Griswold, just to add, not to minimize the issue that you've raised, is that that's one of the reasons why storm sewers work well as a long-term obligation bond. Because as the new residents move in, they're contributing to the sales tax revenue and the utility revenue that we then utilize to pay that long-term debt. So over a period of time, they are helping to some extent. But again, you're right that it's probably not a full pay-as-you-go growth paying for itself. But they do have that opportunity over time because of the length of the debt that's out there.
Thank you.
Vice Mayor.
Brian, I thought that was one of those areas where we actually had increased impact fees in certain areas for the storm sewer impact.
We do have a storm sewer impact.
And isn't it?
Stormwater impact.
But isn't that higher in certain parts of the community than others?
It is. In some parts of the community, there's no impact fee at all.
Right. Like downtown, I think the determination was that there was no new impact.
Correct.
So it is somewhat tied, although it doesn't address the ongoing loss.
Yeah, the difficulty is you wouldn't be able really to support a bond issuance. Impact fees wouldn't work.
Yeah.
In other communities, what they'll do, getting to Larry's point, is that I know in San Antonio we assessed a stormwater fee, and essentially that fee, we divided it by use, residential, commercial, and then you also looked at impervious cover. And that's how you begin assessing the fee, and then they did issue bonds off of that fee. But it's another fee that's tacked on to.
Actually, in 2001, I believe I suggested that to the council, and I didn't get any support. That's why Larry was smiling at me. I think he remembered that.
It's difficult once your city gets much further built out because then you're trying to recover back those costs.
Okay. Any other questions on this? All right. Thank you. Number four is hear a presentation and discuss the solid waste management program.
Mayor and Council, while staff is making their way up to the microphones for the presentation, I'd like to make an announcement this time. I'm pleased to announce after a very thorough recruitment process, the city manager is pleased to announce that Willie Black has been chosen for the position of Solid Waste Management Director. Willie has over 25 years of experience in the solid waste management field. He's been with the city since 1982, and he holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration from the University of Phoenix. So we'd like to congratulate Willie. He competed against a pretty tough crowd. Jack put him through the ringer. He had him taking tests next to my office, and they were sweating in there, taking typing and doing written and oral exams, so we're glad to find that we have a very qualified individual amongst us, and so we just wanted to make that announcement and let the council know about that. And in order to really put him through the test, thought we'd bring this presentation to the council today. So final oral exam here.
Good luck.
Okay.
Thanks, Chris. I'll kick this off. First, I'd like to introduce Mariana Reyes, who is our Marketing Education Coordinator in Solid Waste, Ray Frolick, who is our research analyst, and of course, Willie Black now does not need any introduction. This coming Monday, the 19th, he'll be our new Solid Waste Management Director. Okay. A few months ago, City Council asked us, kind of in general terms, to give us an update on where we are with our Solid Waste Management Department. And to that end, we've thrown together a PowerPoint that just touches on the general aspects of where we are and what we're doing. And I'd like to kick it off. And as we've been
team managing since July, since Christine Zalanka left Solid Waste and went to Development Services, and Carrie Kent went to Neighborhood Services. I'm exceptionally happy that Willie's going to take on this role Monday, because we were actually team managing for quite a while. It was a lot of fun, but it's time now to give it up to Willie. We can start our PowerPoint. Our first slide just introduces this presentation, just to provide you a general overview, a reminder of what our mission simply is, committing to excellence in delivery of solid waste services to basically everybody in Mesa, residents, businesses, and visitors. Some of our programs that are important to us, of course, is our curbside collection program. That's your typical blue, black, and green barrel. We service 115,000 residential accounts. I like to say that we make 12 million house calls a year. The front-loaded trash system, recycling bin system, of course, about half of that is multi-family service, and the other half is in the open competitive commercial market. We have roll-off service also, that is about half of that is a commercial open competitive market, and the other half is our Clean Sweep, Green Sweep program that we'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation. Of course, we have bulk item and appliance collection. Anybody can call our solid waste offices and have boxed or bagged or tied bulk items or appliances picked up. We have household hazardous waste collection events. We have one upcoming, and Mariano will talk about that. From that program, we have a great paint reuse program where we gain thousands of gallons of paint every year and give it to the community. Of course, Christmas tree, interestingly, many years ago when we started this, we would collect around 10,000 trees. Now we're down to about 1,000, and it has a lot to do with people using artificial tree substitutes and the green barrel, which I estimated during our pilot we'd have about 10,000 homes in that program. We have over 33,000 today, so I missed the mark on that. And of course, we have our residential landfill use program where our citizens can go to the landfill with pickup loads and be able to properly dispose of those things. And we still have a couple of drop-off recycling centers in the city, one in the Dobson Ranch area and one on Power Road for residents that are in multifamily complexes that just don't have room for bins for recycling. Just a little bit on our budget, and this slide reflects a yearly audit that we have done every year through our audit department that reflects our total revenues, our expenses, and then the contribution to the general fund. A little over $1 million of that is from our commercial enterprise that we openly compete in every year. This is before indirect costs that I call non-go-away costs. So it's about $1.1 million that's contributed every year to the general fund before that, and about $700,000 after indirect costs are charged out. Also, landfilling and processing and recycling rates, just to catch up on that, we go to four different locations now for disposal. We use transfer stations now in Southeast Mesa. The average cost is about $22 per ton. We have a green waste processing. Typically, most of that is from green barrels. It does cost money to process green waste, but it's a lot less than landfilling, and it doesn't go into the landfill and takes up daily space. And of course, our recycling revenue, we have, we think, a pretty good market today, is a plus $28 per ton. So if you're looking at the net savings, if you can take one ton away from a landfill at $22 and actually make $28 by taking it and getting recycled, there's a net difference of $50 per ton. So that's, we're in real good shape with reference to that. Our focus now is getting more into that blue barrel and less into the black barrel to make that $50 mean a lot more. Today's topics, we're going to talk about several topics. Mariano will begin by talking about the first four, and then Ray will talk about our Phoenix benchmark. Ray presented this last year. We decided in order to look at efficiencies and collections, one of the things we could do is just use the Phoenix program, the private public comparison model they use, and see how we fare with reference to their costs. And we did, and we do, and will continue to share those reports with Waste Management and also Allied Waste. We sat with them a month or two ago and shared our costs with them. We do have a good rapport with both of those companies, in as much as we contract with them on our transfer stations. So without further ado, I'll hand off to Mariano to start talking about our curbside program. Thank you.
Thank you. What we wanted to do is kind of share with you guys the level of volume of trash recyclables that solid waste actually handles throughout a given year. And so we pulled together some numbers from our fiscal year of 2005-06 and just kind of briefly recap some of the tonnage amounts that we had. As was mentioned, we currently service over 115,000 customers. And if you look at the tonnages, kind of does a breakdown of what each barrel we collected. When you look at the blue barrel, you know, in 2005-06 we did over 32,000 tons, which basically helped us divert about over 18% of the total curbside waste stream out of the landfill and into a recycling facility. And when you look at the savings that you can realize, for 2005-06 we actually had a revenue of over $550,000 generated, in addition to the avoided landfill cost of over $730,000, so we actually had a combined positive result of over $1.2 million. So that's why it's important to us to always increase that diversion rate. When you look at the green barrel in 2005-06, you know, as Jack had mentioned, we have over 33,000 customers currently using this voluntary program, and it continues to grow, and we are operating at a full cost recovery, and in fiscal year 2005-06, we had an avoided landfill cost savings of over $70,000. So again, it's to our advantage for residents to use this option when appropriate. In that previous slide, we had shown what the current diversion rate was, but we also wanted to present to you what the diversion has looked like over the past couple of years. So this graph right here talks about the blue barrel diversion rate. As you can see, for the most part, it stayed relatively consistent until the current fiscal year of 2006-07, where you see we've increased by 1%. Part of the reason for this increase is we are in the middle of doing our recycling re-education campaign with our residents, which is actually funded through a grant, and I'll be talking about it a little bit further later in the presentation. We also wanted to take a look at our green barrel program. Again, as you can see, over the past couple years, we have seen a steady increase in it. And it's important to note that this can vary significantly. It's all based on the climate conditions. Obviously, when it's an above normal rainy season, you have more vegetation growth, and yard waste tends to weigh more because of water retention, i.e. wet grass versus dry grass. So it is something that we continue to see increasing. As I mentioned, right now we're in the middle of doing a recycling re-education campaign. Last year, we actually received a grant from the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality for $54,000, and that was to initiate the Sort Your Stuff campaign, which we implemented beginning in spring of 2006. And basically, our whole goal of the program is to have people think twice about when they're disposing of their items, that before they automatically throw it into the trash can, think twice and see, is it recyclable under MESA's program, and put it in the appropriate container. Results to date, since the campaign started, recycling tonnage has actually increased 6% over the previous year, which we're excited about. And as I mentioned, right now we're in the middle of the final phase three, which is affecting the eastern part of the city. And it will be our final campaign, and we're actually going barrel to barrel, delivering recycling information and talking to residents.
Can I ask a question on the tonnage? If the tonnage goes up by 6%, don't you have to figure out how many people are also collecting? Is your number of customers also going up by?
Yeah. It's the
what's the net?
It's the rate of diversion that is going up, so it discounts growth.
Okay.
It's the total.
Yeah, but it's the rate of diversion. Therefore, growth can continue, but the rate of diversion does not take into effect the growth rate.
All right.
That's a clean net increase of 6%.
All right. Just wanted to verify that.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right.
So just looking at these results, we also calculated what the financial impact of is from that, and we basically realized we had an approximate $79,000 net annualized gain, $36,000 of it coming from the additional recycling revenue, in addition to the $43,000 in avoided landfill cost savings. Next, kind of want to talk about our Clean Sweep, Green Sweep program.
It was available on a limited basis. This year was actually, it came back through an approved bar. And basically the containers, as far as the background, this is our neighborhood beautification program. Residents can request to have containers put in their neighborhoods, and it's to help clean up the neighborhoods or whatnot. The containers are used for two purposes. About 55% were allocated to the Building Stronger Neighborhoods program. So we're working with neighborhood outreach and working with the neighborhoods that they've identified that they like to target, and working with them and making those containers available to residents. The remaining 45% are available for neighborhood cleanup. So those are just residents contacting us and wanting to set up a cleanup in their area. And it has been a very popular program, and we're booked through the end of June. But we are doing some tentative scheduling for past June 30th for our annually scheduled neighborhoods, because we do have a lot of neighborhoods that like to have these events on a regular basis.
This is, by all accounts from neighborhood leaders, this is the most popular thing that the city of Mesa does. I hear it all the time. They would like us to do more. We all know why we aren't doing more. But one of the good things that we don't think about, it's not a solid waste side effect. There is a great solid waste side effect, which is that we don't have the dumping that we might otherwise see. But it also brings neighborhoods together. So this is your contribution to neighborhood services as well, making neighborhoods more familiar with each other and safer. So thanks for your work on this.
Also, I think waste management has contributed. I was at a project where they were cleaning up an older man's house, and they took a giant roll off and a half out of his backyard. They'd already moved the five cars and the two RVs out of there, and so it is quite great. And I appreciate the private industry donating dumpsters every occasionally to neighborhood services when we need them. So it's been a great partnership, and I'll tell you, it makes a neighborhood look so much better to get the broken furniture and the dead bikes and everything out of the front yards and the old trash. It just in one day, a neighborhood all of a sudden looks a lot better. This man had had 13 half bikes in his backyard. I found Indian treasures there. So, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yes, it does continue to be a very popular program. Of course, we have a great staff that manages it and is out there interacting with customers and those kind of things. So it's something that we're really proud to have. We also want to provide you a glimpse on some of our solid waste customer service statistics. In fiscal year 05-06, we actually, a call volume was over 82,000 calls that our staff handled. And of those, some of them may be general questions, people asking about recycling, wanting to know when the next household hazardous waste event will be, et cetera. And then of those, one-time service requests could be somebody calling in, asking for an appliance pickup, a bulk item, requesting a roll-off container. Those are over 53,000. So we handle a huge amount of calls into our area. What we also want to do is we like to monitor how well we're servicing our customers. So we do a random phone survey. And on a scale 1-5, 5 being the highest, our overall service was rated at a 4.55. So again, it's something that we're really pleased about. And our customers are acknowledging that we are meeting their needs and handling their trash and waste collection services. Now we'll go into the residential services benchmarking portion.
Last year, we presented a benchmark for residential trash and recycle collection using a cost model.
Make sure you pull one of the mics around.
Sorry.
There you go. Thank you.
Last year, we presented a benchmark for residential trash and recycle collection using a cost model that Phoenix developed. The Phoenix model provides a forecast for the next fiscal year. And last year, we presented that forecast for 2005-06. And today I'm going to present the actual cost for 2005-06, compare that against forecast, and discuss some of the causes for the variation, for the variance. The Phoenix's goal in their model is to provide standard service level to all customers, whether it's served by the city or by the private sector. And the Phoenix's also has a goal of providing an incentive for city staff to contain costs and improve efficiencies to maintain their average cost as low as possible. They use this cost model to calculate the direct cost for residential trash and recycling. They periodically accept bids from the private contractors in selected bid areas, typically 1/6 of the city. And the private contractor bids are compared against the Phoenix calculated average. The Phoenix average is lower than the private bids, and Phoenix will provide the service. And if any of the bids are below the Phoenix average, then Phoenix will contract out to the lowest bidder. And our goal for establishing this benchmark is using the Phoenix costing model as one tool that can provide a general estimate of how the City of Mesa solid waste collection costs compared to Phoenix and to the private contractor bids that are submitted in Phoenix. So give us a general idea. And we have began tracking this as an estimate of the costs each month right now. This is a review of the process that we followed. Last year and this year, we've had the model reviewed and verified by a City of Mesa auditor to determine that all cost figures were accurately obtained from appropriate sources, and that any estimates and assumptions were reasonable and appropriate in accordance with the requirements of the Phoenix model. And that was verified. And last year, I spent extensive time with the Phoenix auditor to make sure that I had totally followed all of the requirements of the model, and this year again reviewed some of the questions I had with the Phoenix auditor. And for the results, the first three items there, the bids that were submitted for 2005 and 06 and the Phoenix average were presented last year, and the 494 was our forecasted number for the City of Mesa, and our actual came out to be 483, so we came in better than the forecast. Identified there were three main reasons why we had this positive variance. One, and they all result to management decisions that were made during 2005 and 2006. The most significant one was we had been running these small 10-yard trucks. They go into neighborhoods, cul-de-sacs, and other streets where the big trucks couldn't turn around. So we had these small trucks on routes where they'd go to one area and they'd jump to another cul-de-sac, another area, and they spent a lot of miles picking up just a few barrels here, a few barrels there, and because their capacity is low, they would fill up quickly and have to take extra loads to the landfill. They're very inefficient, and Willie Black did an analysis of what we could do perhaps to retire these vehicles. They were getting old, and had to make the call on whether or not we would replace them. And Willie determined that with foreman assistance on backup, so the foreman go out there and help the operators back up out of these tight areas, that the foreman did have the time, would be able to do it. And we retired the 10 yards and just built those other pickup areas in the routes that are already out there with the large trucks. And this saved about 3 cents per household per month. And actually, because it went into effect in January, it actually saved about 6 cents per household per month. So this is in the solid waste world, this is a major productivity gain. When we're our operators are already picking up 160 barrels an hour in service, and we have to pass every house two times a week, this saved over 500 miles a week, and all the operator time involved in 500 miles. So it's very significant. We'll take that. That's at 6 cents per household per month. That's a significant achievement of Willie's decision there.
Question. I know I have some constituents who have contacted me who are very concerned about safety when you have a large truck that's backing up. So how are you addressing that?
Handle that one, Willie, on the operational end?
As far as the operation goes, we route our vehicles so that they don't have to back up. And in the occasion they do have to back up, we have backup cameras on the trucks that the driver can see behind the vehicle. We constantly educate the operators about the dangers of backing and look before you back. If you can't see anything back there, worst case, get out of the truck and look.
And am I misunderstanding what you just said? I thought you said that you increased the amount of backing up as a result of this change. Did I misunderstand that?
What happens, we have difficult to collect areas.
Yes.
And what we've done in those situations is there's a foreman out there assisting the operator in backing, and it's required.
Okay.
That's right on the operator's
map. So you have another person there helping?
Yes. Okay. And they're guiding them and bringing them back safely.
And do they get out of the vehicle and look or something like that?
The foreman gets out and guides them back.
Excellent. Thank you.
If I could just add, because of the type of service we have, certainly front loaders always have to back up. And when they approach a front load bin, they dump it, they have to back up. So we have cameras and We always ask our drivers to use judgment, and if there's any doubt whatsoever, any question, they get on the radio, they get a foreman to help them back up. Other than that, you know, they're professionals, they have cameras. You know, we back up every day. But the idea is to make sure they use good judgment and they always have help available when they need it.
For the unsophisticated residents of Mesa, including myself, who now are going to expect my solid waste portion of my utility bill to fall to $4.83 a month, why don't you explain to people what, because I mean, it's that's not the amount we pay. I mean, I can't remember what mine is, but it's somewhere in the $18 to $20 a month range. What's being picked up by that additional money that's not covered by this average cost per household?
Maybe I could take that. This is simply the cost for collecting the residential barrel, in this case, the blue and the black barrel, once a week, each one of them.
I only have a residence.
Yeah, there's many, many other services that we have. We have overhead, we have customer service, people that take calls, we have inspectors that go out, a lot of other costs that may not be comparable from city to city. So therefore, the Phoenix model took the specific service that they knew that they could compare city to city and with the private industry. It would be the service that you could contract to a private hauler simply to go in and collect barrels while you still had this support system to be able to address all the issues, whether it's regulations or customer calls.
Right, that's what I just wanted to point out. There are a lot of other things that go into what we actually get charged as a residential customer other than this.
Yeah, for example, half of our costs are landfilling. You know, a half of a total cost for a solid waste service is the cost of landfilling, not collections.
Which is not in this number.
Which is not in this number.
But like, for instance, if Allied Waste is one of the bidders here and they have their own landfill, is there a cost savings to the ultimate customer if Allied Waste dumps, they pick up for $5.72 per month, but then they dump in their own landfill and avoid the landfill cost? Is that a savings that gets passed on to the customer?
Yeah, typically what we do is we compartmentalize these services so that we can always match up apples with apples. And we do bid out disposal. For example, and Ray will probably talk about another penny he saved with reference to going to transfer stations. For example, we do go to an Allied transfer station. They bid on that competitively. They take what we bring them and they transfer it to tractor trailers and they haul it long haul to their landfill in Maricopa.
Right.
So we kind of break them down and compartmentalize them so we can have competition, I think to the highest degree, component by component.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if a private sector company like Allied or Waste Management have their own landfills.
Yes.
If we, whether we do it through a transfer station or take it directly, we have to pay to dump one of our trucks at their landfill. So that's an additional cost over and above this number. Does Allied Waste, if they were to pick it up, do they have that additional cost because they're dumping at their own facility?
If they're running their own service, mm-hmm. Commercially?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. They would have to pay for the operation of the transfer station, the operation for the tractor trailers, and also the complete operation and capital recovery of the landfill.
So that is true apples to apples. Okay. Absolutely. I wanted the people to understand that there's a lot of things that go into this number other than just this number, so that people don't look at their bill tomorrow and say, wait a minute, yeah. I just saw on Channel 11 that it's only $4.83 and I'm paying $18. Well, who's getting the other $14? And that's the first question that they would ask. So I just wanted to get that distinction. Thank you.
Yeah, that is a very good question. And these numbers are the direct costs only for operators, foremen, and vehicles that are computed in this. Two other decisions that provided some savings. One was an RFP for disposal sites in East Mesa that saved us time and miles And that came out to almost 2 cents per household per month. And one other thing we did was some residents had their collection days swapped to better balance the number of recycled trucks that go out each day. Prior, we'd have some days that sent a lot of recycled trucks out, and the next day we didn't send very many. And so what happened was some of the vehicles would come back in with a partial load, a quarter or a half load of recycle. They had to be used for trash the next day, and then they'd have to take these partial loads to the MRF and dispose of the recycled material before they go out on the trash routes. So by swapping some of these days out, we balanced pretty much almost 12 trucks a day on recycle. So if you come in with a partial load, you're going out on a recycle route again the next day, and you're avoiding that. So it saved about a penny per household per month. So it came up to identifiable savings of about 6 cents or so, and it still left us with about 5 cents per household per month. That could not be attributable to any single operational change, and it was either the result of numerous small changes that are implemented as part of solid waste's continuous quality improvement process, or they were a result of the forecast error. And that is one risk of forecasting that is always in there. I did, when I made the forecast, I was a little conservative on some of the assumptions. I didn't want to overstate the case, and so some of that discrepancy is a result of that. But in any case, it's about, we were off by about 5 cents total that we can't identify.
Tom?
Yes.
Just, you know, it's a lot easier to sit there and explain why you're 11 cents under than being 11 cents over. So take this position, this awkwardness, any time you can. Embrace it.
Will do.
I absolutely agree. It's a positive variance. We love good news. I mean, that's a great thing. Perhaps I should have asked this in the previous question, but and maybe you stated it. What percentage of the trash that's going into the black barrels do you estimate could actually go into blue barrels instead of black barrels?
We actually did a waste sort of our own about a year ago in December of 2005, mm-hmm. where we took a sample of trash. And we actually sorted through, and we actually determined about 25% of that material could have been recycled under Mesa's recycling program in the Blue Barrel. Then we've started the recycling re-education campaign, and we actually first started in that area that we did the sample study. Well, then this past December, we went back into that same area, collected the same neighborhood, did another sort, and we actually determined now we were down to 12% of material. So we were pleased that we did see that that drop in the amount of recyclable material that people are throwing into the black barrel, but certainly there's still another amount out there that we should be able to capture and we want to capture.
Well, one of the thoughts, and maybe it's just because we just did that police thing, but one of the thoughts I had was that we ought to institute a campaign that says recycle your way to another Mesa police officer. You know, you could get the council to agree that what that savings is would be used to hire a police officer, and you have enough there that you could hire, if people would do it on an ongoing basis, you could hire a police officer.
I'll get Steve Wright on that right away.
I know you think I'm kidding, but the fact of the matter is that when my kids were young, things like that caught their imaginations, and it was what they would come home and bug me about it. Every time the Swaswa lady would come, save water and save water again, I would hear about it, you know, Mom, turn that faucet off. Mom, you need to be, and so those kinds of things capture people's imaginations, and it actually gives them a goal to work for, as opposed to, I'm recycling for some, I don't know why, reason. It gives them an actual reason to do it. So Steve, Chris was serious. Get working on it. Thanks.
Move on to the next. Okay. Any other questions related to the Phoenix model?
Go ahead. Nope, I guess I do.
Just a comment. Sure. My son-in-law, they needed some help with a new car, so one of my deals was help them with the new car. They had to learn to recycle. They've never done that in 4 years, so they had to learn what that blue barrel was for. So it was an interesting experience for them.
Billy, do you want to speak?
No. We'll move on to landfill capacity. And an important part of any hauling operation is disposal and making sure you have adequate room for the future. We have four different contracts, as Jack talked about. Our first contract is with Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community for the Salt River Landfill. The landfill is located at Beeline and Gilbert Road.
They're estimating to be at capacity in 2017 without the use of bioreactor technology. Basically, what a bioreactor is, a bioreactor rapidly degrades organic waste by adding liquid and air to enhance the microbial process. And basically, you get more room by doing this. They're in the permitting process for this with the EPA, and if they are able to get the bioreactor technology going, they're estimating that the landfill capacity could be pushed out to 2020 or 2025. Last year, fiscal year 05-06, we took just over 235,000 tons to the Salt River landfill. The other landfill we contract with is Allied Waste. This landfill is located in Apache Junction on Tomahawk Road, just south of US 60. They're estimating about another 10 to 12 years at their current volumes. In 05-06, we took about 17,000 tons out to Allied. We contract with two transfer stations. The first one, the Cactus Transfer Station, located on Mountain Road just north of Pecos. It's currently owned by Waste Services of Arizona and in process of being acquired by Allied Waste, effective at the end of this month. The waste is transferred to a landfill 15 miles south of Florence. And they're estimating that they've got about 200 plus years of capacity out at that landfill. Currently, we take about 2,500 tons to the Cactus facility. The other transfer station we use is the Waste Management Transfer Station on 80th Street, just north of Warner. The refuse is transferred to the Butterfield landfill in Maricopa. Current volumes are expecting another 100 plus years before they reach capacity. And in 05-06, we took more than 12,000 tons to that landfill. What's coming up new for solid waste for opportunities and challenges? The new 2007 diesel emissions standards required by the EPA. The good of the standard is the reduction in the black cloud that we all identify with diesel engines, a reduction in NOx and particulate matter by 90%. Operational concerns for solid waste is the increased cost for the initial purchase of the vehicles. We're looking at estimate of $10,000 per truck. The increased cost to maintain the particulate trap filters that are required as part of the new emission standards. The additional heat from the engine due to the EGR valve or the EGR recirculating system. The location of the particulate filters close to the cab of the truck that can potentially increase the heat inside the cab for the operator. And another challenge for the industry is once the emission system's been certified by the factory, it can't be moved. So when the cabin chassis goes to the body manufacturer, they can't touch anything that has to do with the emissions. Additionally, the new engines require a special oil separate from the old diesel engines that we have at an increased cost. Fuel economy could be lower with the new engines since we've had to increase horsepower because of the new emissions. Solid Waste Management has 15 trucks on order right now. Three of the trucks are coming with the 07 emissions engines, and 13 of those have the 04 emissions systems on them. Next thing that we're looking at is we talked about the residential landfill use program out at Salt River Landfill. We're looking at amending our current contracts with Waste Management and Allied Waste so that residents in the Southeast Valley can utilize the same program at the Waste Management Transfer Station and the Allied Landfill. What the advantage is for the citizens is it's obviously closer for them to go out there. It'll relieve some of the backlog and lines at the Salt River Landfill. The other thing that we're reintroducing is the in-home containers. As part of our efforts to increase our recycling diversion rate, we reintroduced the 28-quart recycling in-home container. In addition, we'll be promoting the availability to existing customers. This goes to all new customers as new barrel delivery, but existing customers have the opportunity to get one of these containers just by calling in, and they can stop by our office and pick one up.
Why isn't it blue?
That's a good question, Mayor. Many, many years ago, we did focus groups on the whole blue barrel program, and there were a couple of women who had a real problem with the color blue in their kitchen. So we went to neutral colors.
You bet. I agree. Yep. I absolutely agree.
Okay. Got it. It does have blue ink on it, so
that's good. That's good.
We're pretty excited about reintroducing the in-home container, and we've actually taken a look at, Ray's taken a look at the our payback on the in-home container, making it easier for a resident to sort in the kitchen. Just 1 pound per household. We get payback in 2 years and 10 months on the container. We'll open it up now for questions.
How are you going to distribute those? What if individuals that really don't want them? So how do you get rid of the, is there a request or?
Well, currently, Mayor, what we'll do right now is for new residents, we'll deliver the 2 barrels plus this container outside the barrel, by the way. We used to deliver it inside the barrel. We used to find it in the recycling center. So that didn't work. You live and learn. And they also have a packet of information that they can call us. Any concerns they have with that, we actually hope that they call us so we can talk to them about it. But we found, since we stopped that, again, I guess the focus group was ringing true many years ago. If you don't have a way to sort it inside your house, inside your kitchen especially, the odds are it doesn't get into the blue barrel. So most people will do this. They might call us and say we already have one. They can drop it off, or we can pick it up. Our foremen are out in the city every week. Mariano is going to do some education on open line and on the website, allowing people to call who can drop down at the Mesa Drive Center. Maybe we'll be able to open something over at East Mesa Service Center for those who want to drop by and pick up a container.
Vice Mayor.
You know, so many of us are shredding now. Because of concerns about identity theft, and so we shred a lot of our things. And my assumption is that I can't put the shred in the barrel. Is that true?
No, you can put the shredded paper in the barrel. We ask that because many people bag them. We ask that they not bag it if they don't.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
Actually, you do want to bag your shredded paper when you throw it into the blue barrel container. This was a question that kept coming up from residents, so we actually went down to the recycling facility and asked them there, what is the best method for people to throw it into the blue barrel? And what they told us was, because the paper can be so small and it's going through the sorting process, if it's left unbagged, it can end up just showing up as residual and actually can't be separated out. So what they had informed us was to let residents know that if you are going to be throwing shredded paper into the blue barrel, it needs to be bagged and tied in a clear plastic bag, not an opaque garbage bag, none of the black hefty bags or anything like that, a clear bag. So what happens is it's going through the processing site, the sorters cannot easily identify it as, yes, it is shredded paper, and they can put it aside into the proper pile. Because what happens if they see a bag that is either opaque or black or whatnot, they're assuming it's trash, and if they tear it open and it is trash, it's now contaminating the recyclable materials. So that's the only time that a plastic bag would ever go into a black barrel, because in general, plastic bags are not acceptable in Mesa's recycling program. We always tell residents, for those things, take them to your nearest grocery store that does accept them or reuse them as garbage bags.
So Jack just learned something new too. Me too. That's a...
Mayor, Council Member Walters, Vice Mayor Walters, I come from the old school that I don't let the recyclers lead too much of my program. Simple and convenient is really the name of the game. If we get too complicated, and if we do everything they tell us to do, we'll have to gift wrap everything. But that's a great idea, but you know, if we find shredded paper on that conveyor belt, they'll pull it off and they'll recycle it.
Okay, so either clear plastic or what we've been doing in our home is we thought we couldn't, and so we've been putting it into the trash. So that's more that we could have been recycling.
And you know, over the years, they've because of their industry standards, they've continued to tell us and ask us to do specific things. And I continue to tell them that if we don't make it convenient and simple,
absolutely,
we lose.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so those who want to bag it, that's great. But if you've got paper. Any kind of paper that is not dirty, please put it in the blue barrel.
My sister was living in San Jose, California, and they had something like 7 different recycling things. Yeah. And I said, we just throw it all in. And she said, that would be the most amazing thing.
Yeah. Okay. Mike?
How many people are aware, and maybe in your campaign you could do this about the larger barrels? My household fills a large blue barrel every week. So I'm sure that we're not unique in the fact that we use a laundry basket for in-house, which fills up very, very quickly. But it's a way, you're right, it's having something inside is a much easier way to get it out. But I think a lot of times, because the Blue Barrel is so small, people won't use it for cardboard boxes and those type of things. So maybe the big one is, and how much more do you pay for the big one?
And actually, the blue recycling containers, there's no additional charge for extra ones. So what we do tell residents, and it's on our website, and it's on the material that we are distributing out to neighborhoods, is, you know, if you are generating a lot of materials and you're finding a lot of it's recyclable, it's much more to your advantage to actually use the blue recycling container, which they can have as many as they want. There's no additional charge. It's just a matter of giving us the call and letting us know, and we can get one sent out to them.
So people know we do have the full size blue barrel, same size as the black.
Correct.
That works well.
Correct.
Is there a small blue barrel?
The standard blue barrel that most residents get when they get, when they have it, is a 60 gallon. However, there is a 90 gallon blue barrel available.
Vice Mayor.
This might be a good opportunity also to mention the smaller black barrel, which I hadn't become aware of and I hadn't remembered. And now we're down to just a few folks at our house from what used to be a gigantic family. And so going to the smaller one over the course of a year, I think you can save, what, about $25 to $30?
Yes, when we, you're talking the difference between a regular 90-gallon barrel and a 60.
Uh-huh.
And it's a couple dollars difference. We try to promote that. Just like the 90-gallon blue barrel, our drivers are pretty good ambassadors. When they see overflowed 60-gallon blue barrels, we ask them to call it in. We'll get the address, and we'll try to contact the resident to say, did you know we had a larger blue barrel at no extra cost to you? Initially, when someone calls, we try to get our customer service reps to get a sense of maybe the size of the family. And if it's two persons or one person, we'll suggest that they might want to consider the 60-gallon black barrel rather than the 90-gallon.
Which is, but for us, we've had the 90-gallon forever, and now, you know, it's the downsizing thing, that we can call you and we can get a 60-gallon. So put that on your list. I need a 60-gallon, which is, yeah. Thanks.
Me too. Okay.
I need a 120.
Is there a baby?
Maybe.
All right, I think we're on the question portion. Any other questions that weren't asked as we went along? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Item five is hear reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Anyone have any updates? Vice Mayor.
Well, first I'd like to hear from Council Member Whalen. Is there any announcement here?
1 o'clock yesterday, Jack Whalen arrived, 7 pounds, 3 ounces. 20 inches.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Mom and baby doing fine.
And it's John Michael Whalen?
John Michael Whalen, a.k.a. Jack.
Excellent. As with a couple of other members of the council, I was in Washington, D.C. for the last weekend. I'm now the vice chair. I've got vice covered. Nationally, locally, I am all about vice. The vice chair of the Community and Economic Development Steering Committee for the National League of Cities, and I'm proud to tell you that I pushed very hard, along with a number of other members of my committee, to shift the focus to economic development. We understand why there has been concern among cities regarding CDBG in recent years, but a lot of us wanted a stronger focus on economic development, and particularly we're going to be focusing on cities being competitive in a global economy, partnerships with the federal government, best practices, and also, you know, how you do economic development in an internet age. So that's going to be our focus this year.
Excellent. All right. Rex?
The mayor and I were at the Russian Philharmonic Orchestra, actually, over at the Art Center, which is very interesting. I was at the Sydney Opera House a few years ago, and the acoustics there in our new one, the wood interior, was outstanding. And I'm not a great, you know, listener to high fidelity. I was at the East Valley Neighborhood Crime Summit with the county attorney speaking, about 100 neighborhood leaders on how to reduce crime in neighborhoods, and good turnout and good involvement. A Tunnel of Forest meeting last night. We have a huge national forest that adjoins Mesa, which is a very nice place to enjoy your leisure time. And I just attended my first board meeting at the Mesa General Hospital, trying to keep a hospital downtown. So those are the main things.
Yesterday morning, actually, had with some other elected officials. Kyle Jones was there. I was there with Senator McCain and Senator Kyle. I guess the one potential good news is that they were fairly optimistic that there may be something that does actually take place in the next month or two on immigration. We'll see if that does. Also met with Representative Mitchell and Flake, and I think they had some of the same feelings that there may be a potential here to get something done. I think that the federal government is finally admitting that they're not doing what they're the primary agency that's supposed to take care of the border issue. So I think that some of the letters and other things that we've done as councils and the situation throughout the United States has finally gotten their attention. So I hope that something happens. If it doesn't happen in 2 months, I doubt if we'll see anything happen in the next 2 years. And I think most people realize that that's probably the situation there. So that was a little bit more promising than I thought. I thought it was not going to happen at all, and we'll see if it does. All right. Anyone else? All right. Scheduling of meetings and general information, Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Reminder to the council that we do have, there. Well, for some of the council members, there's a Transportation Infrastructure Committee meeting 3:30 on March 19th. Then, of course, on that same day, March 19th, we'll have our City Council study session and council meeting. Also want to let the council know that on Tuesday, March 20th, over the Convention Center, we'll be having recognizing Chief G.T. Fowler, who has actually left the city, I believe, now formally. But we'll have an opportunity to say goodbye to him from 2 to 4 on the 20th. Then, of course, we'll have our study sessions on Thursday, March 22nd and Thursday, March 29th. That's all I have, Mayor. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Scott.
I will not be present at the March 29th study session. I'll be defending my dissertation that morning.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Cheney will be there.
Well, can the citizens come and ask questions?
No.
All right. Do we have any requests to speak this morning?
Mayor, I have none.
All right. That being the case, I have a motion and second to adjourn. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All right. Study session is adjourned. Thank you.